Hello, and welcome into our monthly edition of Looking Up with Mal and Dave from the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. I'm Mal Cameron.
Yes, you are.
And you are.
And I'm Dave McDonald.
I knew that. Our program is heard every third Thursday at 1 o'clock here on WKXL 1450 and WKXL1450.com, celebrating Concord and the Capital Region. What a great show we have today. We've got lots of things going on at the Discovery Center these days.
We sure do. And things are looking very bright.
Very bright.
Yes. As a matter of fact, we'll be talking with a sun scientist today in our next couple segments.
Yeah, he has a flair for the sun. I stole that from you earlier.
I think that I heard a rumor they like to be called heliospheric people rather than sun people.
Well, it looks better on a business card.
It does. Well, anyway, a great conversation coming up. You won't want to miss finding out about solar flares, what causes them, how often they happen, and how they affect you. And they may affect you in more ways than one, even if you're not an astronaut.
Right. And even if you don't have a flair for it or whatever.
That's right. That's getting a little spotty.
Yeah, that's getting old. All right. But it's great to have you all with us today. And just in case you have been out of the loop, yes, we said the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. That's the new name for our new facility. Since we opened our Air and Space Museum, if you haven't been there yet, you've got to come and see it. Lots of great things that have been added to our exhibit area. We have a whole new exhibit area that's two stories high, and lots of great stuff in there, buttons to push and things to learn.
Yes, indeed. And certainly come anytime, come as often as you like. But one day you definitely want to get on your calendar is Saturday, May 2nd. That's Spacetacular Saturday. It's National Astronomy Day, and Spacetacular Saturday is our celebration of National Astronomy Day, May 2nd. It's all-day fun at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
All-day fun. Okay, so what's coming on May 2nd? Who's going to be there?
Well, the New Hampshire Astronomical Society is going to be there.
Of course.
They'll be there in full force with all manner of telescopes for solar viewing. And we'll also have our own telescope in our brand new telescope dome open for solar viewing as well.
It is a wonderful telescope.
It's absolutely
amazing. We've
been
sort of previewing it for a while.
Yeah, some people, you probably have driven by and seen the nice big silver dome that looks like an observatory. And you know what? It is an observatory.
It's an observatory.
And
hopefully the sun will be out on that day.
So yes. And the New Hampshire Astronomical Society will have a lot of information and a lot of neat things to share with people. But we have quite a number of things that will be there specially for that day, one being Axius.
Axius?
Axius will be there.
All right.
And some people may not know what or who Axius is, but if you can picture...
Funny you should ask.
But if you can picture
what or who is Axius, Dave?
I'm trying to get to that.
Okay.
A 12-foot operating robot.
Really?
And
wait a minute, is this a robot with 12 feet?
I don't think
so. It's actually 12 feet tall.
He can be 12 feet tall. He really is quite mobile in being able to get around and move. It's really amazing to watch and actually to listen to because he can be programmed to speak as well. And not only that, but our guests are going to actually, or some of them in any case, will be able to control Axius with their cell phone.
Wow.
I know it's
that
really
sounds dangerous.
He's never been here before. I don't even think he's been in the state of New Hampshire before.
First time in the state of New Hampshire.
Yeah, so you don't want to mix Axius.
We are going to have it on May 2nd.
His premiere debut will be here on May 2nd. Again, all day from 10 o'clock to 5 at night. And we trust the weather will be good. We'll be having some rocket launches. Right. We have a couple of key rocket people coming, our own Phil Schuernard.
Right, who teaches our Rocketeers class.
And Jim Fliss of Fliss Kits fame, who develops all types of rockets.
Man.
He's going to bring a real arsenal, if you will, of rockets with him.
Jim Fliss is rather interesting because he comes out to our Rocketeers camp we have every summer. And one year I know he came with his own invention a rocket. This is a launchable rocket. It's called the Decaffeinator.
The Decaffeinator.
And it, and if you can picture essentially styrofoam cups, take a regular styrofoam coffee cup and then take a second one, turn it upside down and put it on top of that first one. Then put another one on top of that right side up and then another one upside down and so on. You keep going. And he makes a rocket out of all of that and it flies. It's amazing.
That's neat stuff. Neat stuff. Plymouth State University will be there with weather balloon launches. Squam Lakes Natural Science Center will be there. Mount Washington Observatory. Aldrich Astronomical Society is coming with spacesuits for people to try on. Mm. And that'll be kind of neat to get into a real spacesuit. And we'll also will be having our favorite Mr. Phil, or makes all types of balloons. The Wright Flyer will be there, and Curious George. People from the Curious George Cottage up in Waterville Valley.
Wow, that's all on May 2nd. You can get all this information, by the way, on our website, which is www.starhop.com, starhop.com. And then in the meantime, we have a whole series of our Super Stellar Friday series is going on.
Every Friday night.
And tomorrow night, what are we doing?
Well, tomorrow night is New Hampshire History and Space. We're going to be viewing images of the night sky during some of New Hampshire's historical moments as author D. Quincy Whitney reads excerpts from her book, Hidden History of New Hampshire. She's got a wonderful presentation to put together. It'll be a colorful narrative of key moments in our state's history. Yeah, colorful narrative.
Including a couple of our own.
Yes, indeed. Alan Shepard and Krista McAuliffe, of course, are included in the presentation. And then she'll be available after her presentation for her book signing.
All right. And then next Friday, the 24th, I'll be doing a presentation
about galaxies
and the distant universe.
That's the theme for April,
yes,
actually.
Yes, it happens to be for the International Year of Astronomy. And so we're keeping that theme going and looking at galaxies, a little history of galaxies. But in our full dome digital theater, we'll be flying you into two galaxies and through them and out and seeing, get a feel for how many galaxies there really are out there, too.
I know. It's an amazing number.
Billions and billions, as Carl Sagan reportedly said.
Then May 1st, which is the Friday night before Spacetacular Saturday, we are screening Blast, the movie. And Blast is a safe movie, a film by 5-time Emmy winner Paul Devlin. And this is a story that follows his brother, astrophysicist Mark Devlin, Dr. Mark Devlin. He leads a team of scientists on a quest of launching a great telescope by a balloon into space. And the storyline follows the scientists and how passionate they are about what they're trying to do and the sacrifices they make as individuals and their families make. It's a really fascinating story as the camera follows this real project.
Wow. So that's the night before our Spacetacular Saturday, May 1st.
7 o'clock.
And we also have members of the Astronomical Society will be there that night, too.
That's right. So that Friday night, there will be...
The
first Friday of the night. Mm-hmm. And they're going to put on an encore performance, actually, after Spacetacular Saturday. On that Saturday night, they're going to have an encore performance with their telescopes as well. Mm. And we're trusting for good weather
permitted.
Yeah.
But then the week after that, second Friday of every month.
Yep.
Your favorite night.
Teen Night, May 8th. It's the ultimate giant Xbox 360 adventure. So picture playing Xbox 360 on our giant planetarium dome.
Along with David McDonald, the world's oldest teenager.
Thank you. And we're having from 6 to 8 o'clock, teenagers aged 13 to 15. And then from 8 to 10 o'clock, teenagers 16 to 19, and there will be all-you-can-eat pizza entwined throughout both of those sessions.
All right.
And then let me lastly just mention May 15th, Granite State Storms. Kevin Skorupa from WMUR News 9 is going to take us through the past 100 years of the biggest storms in New Hampshire ever experienced, so you're not going to want to miss that one either.
Oh. And also in between, don't forget, we've got our Rocketeers workshop coming up a week from Saturday, April the 25th, from 9 to noon. That's for anybody 8 years old and up. And you can come in and build a rocket and launch it outside. And then we have our teacher workshop, our final one of the school year, on Wednesday, May 13th, about the life and death of stars. If you are an educator, you might want to check into that. All of this you can check out on our website, which is starhop.com.
STARHOP.com.
And it's our new website, by the way.
Too. Yes.
It's really spiffy. So that's it.
Okay.
So we have a guest coming up, right, Dave?
We do, and we'll introduce him right after our break. And you're listening to Looking Up with Mal and Dave from the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. Our program is heard every third Thursday from 1 o'clock on WKXL 1450 and WKXL1450.com, celebrating Concord in the Capital Region. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with our special guest to talk about the sun. Welcome back to Looking Up with Mal and Dave from the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. I'm Dave McDonald.
And I'm Mal Cameron.
And our program is heard every third Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. on WKXL 1450 and WKXL1450.com, celebrating Concord and the Capital Region. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce to you folks our special guest on our show today. Dr. Terry Forbes is on the research faculty at UNH, and he's involved with the physics department there and has a real passion for studying solar flares and works with graduate students in helping them to get their PhDs. So welcome to the show, Terry.
Thank you.
And it's great having you with us. And maybe you could just start the ball rolling on this topic with how did you start to get interested in studying the sun?
Well, it started with as a little kid, really. I think about the age of eight, I was decided I wanted to go into astronomy. And eventually, as I went through high school and into college, I got interested in magnetic fields. And most people know that the Earth has a magnetic field and how compasses are oriented in that magnetic field. It's even more important for astrophysical bodies, stars, the sun, the behavior of the magnetic field. And as time went on, I started out actually working in geomagnetic physics, looking at what are called magnetospheric substorms, which have to do with aurora borealis and the northern lights. And eventually got interested in the storms that occur on the sun. Now, you asked me how I got interested in this. Sometimes jokingly I tell people, they say, well, why'd you get interested in the sun and not working on stars or galaxies? And I always think, well, maybe it's because I was kind of scared of the dark when I was a little kid. And if you go into solar astronomy, you don't have to worry about that. So... and I think, you know, the flares, these explosions that occur on the sun, they were seen about 150 years ago. In fact, this year is the 150th anniversary of the first observation by Carrington, who was an English astronomer, who was looking, recording sunspots daily, making drawings of them.
With a telescope?
With a telescope back in England. And one day he saw this flashing of white light as he was looking through the telescope. And he didn't really... kind of believe what he was seeing. You know, he had not seen that before. Nobody had ever talked about them. And he saw these white flashes, and he ran out to get somebody else to look in the telescope, and within 15, 20 minutes, they were gone. And so by the time somebody showed up, they said, what are you talking about? Okay. Fortunately, there was another astronomer in the London area who was also looking at this and was able to corroborate his observation. And that was kind of the first time anybody noticed something dynamic happening, you know, very quickly on the sun.
So 150 years ago?
150 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
What did they use for solar filters back then?
Well, I think Carrington was doing what most people even now amateurs today, and that is they project the image onto a piece of paper and use the telescope. The sunlight is so bright, you certainly don't want to look into the telescope without a filter.
Right.
And the easiest thing to do is just to project the image onto a piece of paper and get a nice big image, and you can sketch it and look at the spots. So I think that's how he was doing it. That's a fairly common method.
Very good.
Certainly safer than don't try to look at it with your own eyes, and certainly don't look at a full-blown sun through a telescope.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, you don't even want to, without being very careful about the kind of telescope you have, you want to think twice about using any telescope. Too big a telescope, and you can get so much heat in the eyepiece that it will melt the lenses and damage the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, ever since Carrington's observation, there's this really impressive phenomena. Flares are a very powerful explosion. Sometimes I've referred to this as to get an idea of what a modest small flare is like, as if everyone on the Earth had their own 100 megaton nuclear weapon and all pushed the button at the same time, that would make a pretty small flare. So flares are enormous explosions. And if you know about them, it's kind of natural to ask, what causes them?
Well, that was my next question. What causes these explosions?
Yeah. Well, it's taken time to figure out. We know quite a bit now, but we really don't know the full answer yet, or even maybe half the answer. The original observations that Carrington saw were white flashes located on the surface of the sun, what the astronomers call the photosphere.
Yeah.
And it took some time, really, like almost 100 years, where people began to realize that the phenomena is not a surface phenomena, but it's something actually happening higher up in the atmosphere of the sun,
right,
up in the solar atmosphere. And what you see on the surface is are the signatures of particles created up in the atmosphere that hit the surface. It's a lot like the aurora borealis again, in reverse. There you have energetic particles out in space coming down and hitting the Earth's atmosphere.
Hmm.
And the flare has that same type of process going on. So this is one reason why it was easy for me to move from the area of studying the aurora borealis to studying flares. They're closely related phenomena, both involving the magnetic field.
Well, closely related, over 93 million mile distance.
Yeah.
That's close.
I don't know if you call that close or not. Right. But
for one thing, then, what you're saying is that we definitely are affected a lot by the sun. The sun plays a bigger role than just giving us light and heat, then.
Yeah. And these explosions particularly have a kind of dramatic effect on anything that's in Earth orbit, such as the space station, satellites, particular communication satellites that orbit some distance out from the Earth. All of these are subject to particle bombardment from these flares.
Hmm.
And even astronauts going to the moon in the past, when we had those missions were active, they were very concerned about big flares, a really big flare. If they were unlucky enough to get a big flare when the Apollo astronauts were going to the moon, it could conceivably be lethal.
Now, how long, like if a flare happens on the sun, and let's just say you're on the moon or in orbit around the moon, about how long does it take for the particles or the radiation from that flare to reach the moon?
It comes in various stages. And the first thing to get here, of course, is the photons, light.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an intense X-ray emission, which is a form of light, that gets from the sun to the Earth within about 8 minutes. That radiation is intense enough to enhance the ionosphere. It can disrupt communications, and you can see definite effects for radio propagation in the Earth.
So that's traveling the speed of light.
Yeah, it's traveling at the speed of light. And then the next thing, the thing that's really kind of important for in terms of astronaut health and space damage to satellites, are what are called prompt particles, or very energetic particles. And depending on the orientation of the magnetic field in space, these particles can get to the Earth within 15 or 20 minutes. So they're traveling at something like 30% the speed of light. And they're very energetic, very penetrating radiation. They're really a form of cosmic radiation that could enter into the Apollo spacecraft and do damage.
So if you're on the moon and you're looking at the sun, I mean, you can see the sun, and you see this flare happen, the fact that you're seeing it means that some of that material has already arrived, then. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the light has arrived. You can see, if you're looking, you probably have to use a telescope to see the light signature. But the energetic particles basically are not themselves visible, but they get there within, 15, 20 minutes possibly. And when they arrive, if it's a really intense event and you're out in a spacesuit on the surface of the moon, you want to think carefully about writing your last will and testament. But once the, now I don't want to exaggerate this too much. The kind of event that could really literally kill an astronaut within a day or two or within a few hours, that occurs like once every 10 years. Mm. So you have to be pretty unlucky for that.
So would it be reasonable to plan such a prolonged exposure during a solar minimum?
Yeah, they have for the astronauts, they were kind of careful not to go too near maximum. I don't think it was near minimum. There's a problem with, for long space journeys. I've been involved with a panel that was convened by NASA, by the MAN program, to study the radiation hazards, for voyages to Mars, where you would be out in the spacecraft for months on end, and exposed to damaging radiation. And one of the concerns there was that going at solar minimum so as to avoid these flares and the particles they produce has a unfavorable aspect to it, and that is that when the sun is very quiet, cosmic rays produced in other galaxies come into the solar system much more easily.
Right.
So, and these cosmic rays, these particles coming from other galaxies, they come really from supernova explosions.
Mm-hmm. Can we just hold that thought for a moment?
These are very penetrating and almost impossible to shield against.
Can we just hold that thought for just a moment, and then we need to take a quick break here,
okay,
and then we'll come back, and can we pick up where you're leaving off?
Yeah, let's pick it up with cosmic rays.
Pick it up with cosmic rays and a few other things about it, too. So just hang on for a moment. We're talking with Dr. Terry Forbes of the University of New Hampshire, of the research faculty in the physics department over there. And we'll talk some more after a break. You're listening to Looking Up with Mal and Dave from the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. Our program is heard every third Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. on WKXL 1450 and WKXL1450.com. Celebrating Concord in the Capital Region. We'll take a quick break and be right back with our guest. And welcome back to Looking Up with Mal and Dave from the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. I'm Mal Cameron.
And I'm Dave McDonald.
The program is heard every third Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. on WKXL 1450 at WKXL1450.com, celebrating Concord in the Capital Region. We're having a fascinating conversation, Dave, with Dr. Terry Forbes of the University of New Hampshire Research Faculty. And we're talking about the sun and flares, and we left off by talking about cosmic rays.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting how we mentioned that when the sun is quiet, that allows more of these cosmic rays to come in from intergalactic space.
Hmm.
Tell us more about that, Dr. Forbes.
Yeah. Well, the reason that having some solar activity, having flares, decreases the cosmic rays from other galaxies coming into the solar system has to do with the fact that this material coming out from the sun is magnetized. It has a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps to sweep out these energetic particles from the solar system and reduces their radiation. Now, we still haven't gotten back to the point here how it is that the flares create their energetic particles and the magnetic field. And basically what people have figured out in the 150 years since Carrington first saw flares is that they're a magnetic phenomena, magnetic explosion. I sometimes make the analogy with they're a little bit like a jack-in-the-box, believe it or not.
Okay. I can't wait to hear
this. Jack-in-the-box has a coiled spring in it. And in the case of solar flares, solar eruptions, the coil spring is the magnetic field, which is often twisted and wound up and stressed, much like the spring in a jack-in-the-box when the jack is in the box.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus of research has been to try to figure out what it is exactly that you know, is equivalent to opening the box. You turn the handle of the jack in the box, and there's a little mechanism that suddenly releases the spring and allows it to come forth. And something like that happens with flares. People still are trying to figure out, actually, two questions. One is, how does the stress build up? How is it that the magnetic field gets coiled and stressed so much? That appears to happen, the latest thinking on that is that that appears to happen in the interior of the sun, when the magnetic field is created, and it comes up in a very stressed state.
How far down below the surface of the sun are these magnetic fields created?
It goes in about 20% of the total radius of the sun. This is what's called the convection zone.
Okay.
And the magnetic field is thought to originate at the base of the convection zone. So this is at some depth into the sun. And in fact, down in that region where the field forms, it's very, very strong. The number typically is what's called a megagauss field. Here on the surface of the Earth for compass needles, we have about one gauss. So the field down at the base of the convection zone where the field forms is a million times stronger than it is on the surface of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Right. Just for a moment, could you just explain to our listeners who may not know that term gauss, what that
means?
Well,
gauss is a unit of magnetic field strength. And I was trying to give some idea of it by pointing out that the field here on the surface of the Earth is not exact. It's a little bit less than a gauss, and it varies from the equator to the pole. But you can kind of have an idea of how strong a field that is from watching a compass needle. And if you had a compass needle on the sun at the right depth, the forces acting on it to spin it around would be a million times stronger. Because you can imagine that a compass needle might just fall apart under the influence of such a force. So that field rises up through the outer layers of the sun, eventually reaches the surface, and it can sit there in the stressed state for some time, and then all of a sudden it can go pop, just like the jack in the box. And a lot of interest is focused on trying to figure out what are the conditions exactly that make it go pop.
So would that be analogous to perhaps blowing, say, a piece of bubble gum, and it reaches a certain point where the stress just has to release and it breaks open? Or is that too simplified?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a very good analogy.
Well, that's neat. And now, do the flares, like I understand that sunspots come in pairs. Is that related to solar flares?
Yeah, that is. They are related because the flares typically occur in the regions where there are sunspots. These are called active regions.
Okay.
And the sunspot, the plus and minus pairs, you have North Pole on one spot and the South Pole on the other.
And this is like a North and South Pole, magnetically speaking.
That's right. Okay. And the magnetic fields, lines of magnetic force, the kind of thing you see with iron filings when you throw them around the magnet.
Right.
Those form a kind of magnetic loop connecting the North and South Poles. And those field lines that form those loops, that's the stuff that becomes twisted. So you can kind of think of them as wires connecting the North and South Pole.
Okay.
And if you twist stuff around, the wires tend to be coiled. And we see signs when you look at images of hot gaseous material in these fields, you see evidence that there's a considerable amount of twisting in that structure.
Hmm.
And the twist gets too much, apparently that makes the flare happen.
Now, does a flare typically come out of the north or the south magnetic pole?
It actually comes out in between.
Okay, that was my third option.
So you do sometimes see flaring within a spot, but more typically it's in between the spots.
Okay.
The spots can have a lot of structure. The regions that form flares are not a simple isolated plus and minus spot. Usually they're much more complex than that. In fact, typically they involve spots that are very close to one another, that have a lot of mixed polarity, north and south together. In fact, they're often so close that the penumbra, I don't know how many people will know about what a penumbra is around the sunspot. This is the outer region around the spot. These will often be in close connection with one another in a group that typically leads to a flare.
So am I understanding correctly now? I'm thinking, of course, from our listeners' point of view, too, without getting very technical, are you saying that you cannot have flares unless you have sunspots?
Well,
one, you can't have one without the other?
Can't have big flares.
Big flares.
The kind
okay.
that I like, anyway, that I'm interested in. people discuss the possibility of having what are called micro flares and even nano flares. This is the idea that as you look at the magnetic field on the sun, that even outside of sunspots, there are tiny little magnetic features that are being moved around by the turbulence, the convection of the atmosphere of the sun. And there is some evidence that these tiny little features produce tiny little micro flares or nano flares. But they're not the large flare that people worry about for their damaging effects.
Well, now you mention people worrying about them for their damaging effects. And so we, not being astronauts out in a spaceship or walking on the moon here on Earth, protected to some degree by our own magnetosphere. But why should we here on Earth care about solar flare activity?
Well, for me, the number one thing is it's just an interesting phenomenon. But there are practical applications, and so people like myself who do primarily research on this subject receive funding from both NASA and the National Science Foundation, and I've had some funding in the past from the Department of Defense. And their main concern there is on communication assets in space, also the power grid network. I'm trying to think now. It's been almost 20 years ago. I think it was 1989 or 86, somewhere in there, that there was a large flare going on the sun that led to the failure of, I think, 9 hydroelectric power stations in Quebec that feed electricity into the state of New Hampshire.
And what exactly does the material from the flare affect? Does it get into the power lines, or
how it works is that this energetic radiation that hits the Earth, the magnetic field carried with it, it causes currents to flow in the Earth's ionosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Those currents are up about 60 miles up or so. They act like a transformer current, and they induce currents particularly over Canada. To flow in the entire power grid. So it suddenly is, you're kind of waving a magnetic field and currents up in one set of coils, and then the other set of coils, which is actually the power network, responds. Mm-hmm. And so you get surges of electricity flowing in the line. And there is somewhere on the internet a picture of some of the transformers that were damaged in these Quebec hydroelectric stations. Mm-hmm. And the transformers more or less melted. These are big, heavy-duty transformers, much bigger than a person, right at the power station. And New Hampshire lost power, I think, for several hours during the middle of the night when this one event occurred. And I heard about it because the Portsmouth Herald, here in the Seacoast area, was not able to print their morning edition. So they were very aware that something had happened, and I even got a telephone call from the energy office of the governor of the state asking me what had happened, and I think he was kind of incredulous, because at the end he said, "Are you trying to tell me that something from outer space caused this problem?" And I said, "Yes." And he said,
"How about that?
I don't think I can believe that."
Space weather.
Yeah.
Hey, well, Terry, thanks so much for joining us. We're out of time. And thanks for taking part of your day to talk with us about the sun and solar flare activity and why it's important to us.
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, very nice to have you with us.
Well, right.
You're listening to Looking Up with Mal and Dave from the McAuliffe-Shepherd Discovery Center. Our program is heard every third Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. on WKXL 1450 and WKXL1450.com, celebrating Concord and the Capital Region. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back and tell you some neat things that are happening in the night sky. You're listening to Looking Up with Mal and Dave from the McAuliffe-Shepherd Discovery Center. I'm Dave McDonald.
Are you sure?
Definitely.
Okay. And I'm Mal Cameron.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Well, good deal.
If you're Dave, I'm Mal. I'll do it.
We're sure. Our program is heard every third Thursday at 1 o'clock on WKXL 1450 and WKXL1450.com, celebrating Concord and the Capital Region. Hope you enjoyed that chat with Dr. Terry Forbes. That was really quite fascinating, the stuff that he's into.
Mm.
He's really, a very bright.
I love the way he said he got into the field as well, just because when he was very young, he got into it.
Yes. And so he got himself into a magnetic field.
Yes, I guess.
Something like that. So I know.
We may not be able to see the magnetic field, but there's lots of good things going on in the night sky. Right. In fact, coming up in the next few, two or three weeks, right in a row, we've got a couple of meteor showers to look
forward to. It's amazing that we have two meteor showers coming up in a fairly short period of time. The morning of April 22nd, the Lyrid meteor showers.
Mm-hmm.
And where does the name Lyrid come from?
Comes from Lyra or Lyra, which is the constellation of Lyra.
The harp, right? Type.
The harp.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is also a good sign because the harp has a bright, that constellation has the bright star Vega in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the stars of the summer triangle.
It is.
So that means we're getting close to summertime when we can even see that.
That will be awesome. But when we talk about Lyra or Lyra, the constellation, we're talking about the radiant of the meteor shower. So mm-hmm. that's where the meteors appear to be radiating from. But you can enjoy looking through the entire sky. You don't have to say, well, where's the constellation of Lyra? I'm not going to be able to find it. No, just go out the morning before dawn of April 22nd and get a lawn chair, sit back, look up, relax, and look anywhere you like in the sky and enjoy the show. And then the next opportunity coming right up is going to be the evening of May 5th and pre-dawn hours of May 6th. And this is the Eta Aquariid meteor shower.
So now, where's that come from, Mr. Dave?
I'm going to say Aquarius.
Sounds right. Aquarid.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And the kind of.
Why is it called Eta? Do you happen to know? I don't know, actually. So
yes, the stars. The stars.
Does it come from that particular star?
That in that area.
The star in the area of that.
Yeah, in the area of the star Eta Aquarius.
I think I know where you're going.
It's like the
stars,
fifth.
Right.
In theory, it should be the fifth
because it
brightest
uses the
star.
Greek alphabet.
Right.
Alpha, beta, gamma, delta,
epsilon.
Epsilon, which would be five.
Zeta, eta. So seventh.
Seventh.
Seventh brightest star. In theory, it's not an exact formula, but roughly the seventh brightest star in the constellation of Aquarius. But anyway, if you want to know, where is Aquarius? If you go out and you see a number of meteors, if you trace the meteors backwards, if you kind of follow their trail backwards and you can find several meteors that happen and trace them backwards, they will converge in that area of the sky where Aquarius is, and specifically near the star Eta Aquarius.
So you don't really have to know. It's just know that that night there will be another meteor shower.
Yeah. And again, get your lawn chair out, bring some coffee.
Look in all directions.
Hot chocolate. Not sure if you're going to need bug spray quite yet, but...
if you think you need an umbrella, then don't go out because you'll suddenly see anything except raindrops.
A sleeping bag maybe help, but be warm, be comfortable, but stay awake.
But usually the best time is like 2, 3 in the morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be good. And especially during the time of the Lyrids, which is next week, then that's for some people even a school vacation week. So if you're lucky enough to be out of school, then you can stay up late and not worry about having to get up for school the next morning.
Right. That's right. So two great meteor showers, the Lyrids on the early morning of April 22nd. And the Eta Aquariids on the evening of May 5th, early morning of May 6th.
Uh-huh.
Now,
I understand there's a planet out there we can look at.
Yes, and this is a great timing for Mercury because Mercury is elusive, and typically most people don't find Mercury unless you're specifically looking for it because it tends to be in the glare of the sun. You never see Mercury in a dark sky. There's always some glow of the sun there.
It's a challenge.
It is. But the end of April 20 to 30 is going to be a good period of time. April 20th to the 30th is going to be a good time to be looking for Mercury a half hour, 45 minutes after the sun sets in the west. And specifically, April 26th is the time of what we call the greatest eastern elongation, which is when Mercury will be at its greatest angle or greatest distance away from the sun as we observe it here from Earth. So, you know, several days on either side of April 26th, roughly April 20 to the 30th, will be a great window of opportunity to find the planet Mercury. And binoculars may help you find it. And then after you find it, you with binoculars, you should be able to see it quite easily with the unaided eye. So be on the lookout for Mercury at the end of the month, a half hour, 45 minutes after sunset.
Right. And we still have the dominant planet of our night sky out just about, if you go out about, say, 9:30 or so and look pretty much to the south, sitting right under the constellation of Leo the Lion. Leo is the star shape. You start by finding a bright star called Regulus. And if you follow Regulus straight up the sky from there, you'll come to a curve of stars, the whole thing of which will make what looks like a backwards question mark. And to the left of that, you'll find three bright stars that make a kind of a right triangle tipped over on its side. And underneath the triangle part, there is a dot that will not appear to twinkle. And that dot is the planet Saturn. It's a good time to look at Saturn if the night is clear with a telescope because the rings are almost tipped edge on. They're getting ready to disappear. And that's what they will do in September of this year.
I think September 4th is the day of disappearance.
The day of disappearance. Mm-hmm. You'll look at the rings edge on, and even with a small telescope, you'll be hard-pressed to find any rings at all by that time. So they are little by little tipping such so that they're going to be disappearing from view rather shortly, at the end of the summer at least. So that's another good thing to look for out there in the sky.
In the morning, for those who are relatively early risers, you know, an hour and a half or so before sunrise, look for the planet Venus. We all enjoyed Venus for quite a number of months in the evening sky, shining so very brilliantly in the western sky. Mm-hmm. Now Venus has moved into the morning sky. So in the eastern sky, before sunrise, that is going to be the brightest object you're going to find towards the east. Shining, as a matter of fact, on May 2nd at its brightest magnitude of -4.7. And
that's bright.
It is. The smaller the number, the lower the number, the more negative the number, the brighter the object.
And when it gets on one side of the sun or the other, it's interesting how Venus gets to be nicknamed the morning star or the evening star.
Yep.
But it's not really a star. You're actually looking in Venus. And the cool part is, if you have a telescope and want to get up that early and look for it, you're not going to see a round planet. Because Venus being an inferior planet, meaning closer to the sun, not that it's suffering from, you know, feeling inferior. But if it, you know, you're actually looking at like a crescent, it actually goes through phases.
It does.
Like the moon.
And the phase is actually will be on the increase as time goes by. There'll be more and more percent of Venus lit, but it's going to be, it's moving away from us. So it's actually going to be getting smaller and smaller.
Really cool.
So it's a lot of fun to keep your eye on Venus.
That's a lot of good stuff to talk about.
Yep. Well, and maybe the last thing, let's do the arc.
The arc to
the
Arcturus,
arc.
Yes, yes.
The
if you can
the
find
Big
the Big Dipper, you can find one of the brightest stars in the sky very easily this time of year. Just take the handle of the Big Dipper and follow it from the so-called bowl of the Dipper, the major part where the handle attaches, and go backwards away from the rest of the Dipper. Just follow that curve of that handle of the Dipper. And just keep following the curve down the sky. You'll bump into a really bright star. The star is called Arcturus. And it's one of the brightest stars in the sky. It's really beautiful to look at.
It shimmers so, like a jewel.
It sure does. And so when you do it, you can think of arcing off of the handle. So we call that arc to Arcturus. And that's a good way to look at that star. So we're just about out of time, Dave. But before
we
end,
I
want to say that we want to thank WKXL for running our programs for us every single month like this. We really appreciate it.
We really want to send our
good wishes to them and let everybody on the staff know that we are saddened to hear about the death of Gardner Hill, We've worked with him over the years as well.
We sure have.
And we sure will miss him. And I know the whole WKX family misses him too. So our thoughts are with you guys and also with Gardner's family. So thanks for listening.
Thank you. And be sure you've marked down May 2nd, Spacetacular Saturday. Come and meet and control Axios.
Control.
May 2nd at the McCall Shepherd Discovery Center. Well, you've been listening to Looking Up with Mal and Dave from the McCall Shepherd Discovery Center. I'm Dave McDonald.
And I'm Mal Cameron.
And our program is heard every third Thursday at 1 o'clock here on WKXL 1450 and WKXL1450.com, celebrating the Concord and the Capital Region. Thanks for joining us, and until next time,
keep looking up.